All right, let's just start briefly with a prayer. O Heavenly King, the Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, Lover, present to us all things, treasure blessings, and giver of life, come and abide in us, cleanse us from impurity, and save our souls, O good one.
Okay, so we have our class here, and it's not maybe going to be as fancy this time, every time, I mean, but... we do have a little PowerPoint this time. So what I want to focus on is the early church. And when we talk about the early church, that usually refers to the period from the day of Pentecost all the way until basically Constantine, when Constantine legalized Christianity in the beginning of the 4th century. And then Christianity became the state religion of the Roman Empire at the end of the 4th century. And of course, that was a huge thing because the Roman Empire had like half the people in the world in it or something like that at the time. So it was really a huge thing. So anyway, but we're going to look now, starting right with the apostles. And so I'm sure you've seen maps like this before. So here's a map of St. Paul's journeys. Just to give us an idea of the very beginning of the church, of course, beginning in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost, we hear that people soon after are getting converted in all these places. On the day of Pentecost, it mentions, you know, people from these different locations, like Cyrene, Lydians, and then it says Medes, so Persia would be over here, some Christians there, Egypt down here, Ethiopia further down. But anyway, this is where, of course, St. Paul went, and this is a map showing his different journeys. And so the first thing to keep in mind is that, so at this time in the Roman Empire, it was the Roman Empire, and so they spoke Latin, which is, you know, of course, a lot like Italian or Spanish today. But the fact is that the main language that most people spoke was actually Greek, because a few centuries before Christ, Alexander the Great had come and he had conquered all the way to India. And so this entire region, everybody spoke Greek as a result of that. And so that's why the New Testament, even though they're under the Roman Empire, that's why everybody was speaking Greek. And what is now today the country of Greece was centered here, and this was really the area where everybody spoke Greek. This area here where St. Paul really focused. And these cities, and part of the reason he focused in these areas is that these were where a lot of big cities were, and there were a lot of Jews living in these cities. And so St. Paul, as we know, he often, when he would go to a city, he would try to, at first, preach to the Jews. This happens several times in Acts. And it happens in several places that he goes and he tries to preach to the Jews in a city, and they don't want to receive his message, and then he goes and finds some Gentiles who do receive his message. And sometimes some of the Jews do as well. And then he came back to Jerusalem to check in with the apostles a few times, and of course his last journey, which is here in red, was when he was, you know, imprisoned and then taken to Rome, where he was eventually martyred. Here's just another map showing the same kind of thing. So this one has the advantage of showing some of the regional names. So when we hear about, and in the Acts of the Apostles, we hear about like Cilicia, Galatia, Pamphylia, Lycia, and we hear about these places in Acts. And so this just gives us an idea. If we look over here, there's Achaia, which is what we would call today Greece. Of course, at that time, it was really much more divided. Especially in the era before the Roman Empire and before Alexander, all of these little cities were their own countries, effectively. They were city-states. And so they had very unique ways of living, but they all were joined then at this period of St. Paul and the other apostles by all speaking Greek. But we do hear that in the Acts of the Apostles, some of these cities were very different. So, you know, in Corinth, for example, Corinth had been destroyed by the Romans and been repopulated with freed slaves. And so Corinth was a city where there were a lot of class struggles. And we know that from other people at that time, where there's a lot of division because the people who were freed slaves, they caused a lot of social issues there. There were a handful of very wealthy people and a lot of poor people in Corinth, and there was a huge clash between the two classes. And if you read St. Paul's letters to the Corinthians, you hear about this. Actually, you hear about how the church in Corinth is divided in that way. And so that's like an example of a local difference in a city. When we get to, this is just how the map is today, just for us to get an idea, you know, Greece, Turkey. These are the countries as they are today. But when we get to Ephesus, where St. Paul spends 2 years in Ephesus. Ephesus, we hear in the Acts of the Apostles, is a city that is dedicated to the goddess Artemis or Diana. And when St. Paul goes there, there's a huge riot there. And the people keep shouting, great is Artemis of the Ephesians, or great is Diana, it depends how you translate it. But this is Greek goddess. If you learn about Greek mythology or Roman mythology, you know, Artemis, the goddess of hunting and things like that, the moon maybe as well. In Ephesus, like her, the whole city was dedicated to her. Much like in Athens, it was dedicated to Athena. And so we know that, too, that part of the reason that St. Paul was really persecuted, too, was in a place like Ephesus, because they were the head city of the cult of Artemis. Anybody who wanted to, like, go on a pilgrimage to honor Artemis would go to Ephesus, and they would buy some little statues and other things like that. And so when St. Paul went there and was preaching that, you know, all these gods are made up, you know, worship the one God, his son Jesus Christ, they were really upset there. And it was because of the economic impact that this would have, because you had all these merchants who sold all this stuff, made lots of money to all these people who would come to these shrines. And that was, it says the main person against him was this this metalsmith guy who would make stuff. And so he really upset people and the other apostles. And that happened in lots of cities, but that's a particular thing that's mentioned in Acts in Ephesus. So as a footnote, many of these cities today, of course, some of them exist. Athens is the capital of modern Greece. Thessalonica is a very large city today. And other cities are almost completely wiped out, and just a few ruins are left. Like Ephesus, there's basically nothing there. I think there's just a few ruins. And a lot of these cities are like that as well. So, anyway. So I think I'll go for like 10, 15 more minutes, and we'll have some questions. So then to go into the period of the persecutions, Peter and Paul, as we heard yesterday at the liturgy, Peter and Paul were martyred very close together in time in Rome. There's some debate about what year it was exactly, but we do know that in the year 64, there was a fire in Rome, a huge fire that wiped out half the city or something. And the emperor Nero blamed this fire on the Christians. Now, some historians now speculate that Nero actually started this fire himself in order to clear the city and build himself a new palace and also, you know, kill off a lot of the poor people who were, you know, bothersome. But, you know, so he, there's some speculation about that, because he wasn't even in Rome when it happened, very conveniently. Now, in the book of Revelation, when it says the number 666, in Hebrew, and then also, I believe still at that time, maybe even in Greek and Roman, but in Hebrew, the number 666 also correspond with the word Nero, is how it would sound. And so there's some speculation there that when they in the book of Revelation, when they refer to 666, it's actually referring to Nero, who was at that time persecuting the Roman emperor who was persecuting Christians. And of course, when he did that in Rome, then these persecutions sprung out all over the empire. Around the same time, kind of overlapping with that, the Jews, who had remained Jewish, the bulk of the Jews, they revolted against the Roman rule in Galilee and then in Jerusalem. And so there was this first Jewish war. There was a Jew who then switched sides and became a Roman general, Josephus, who wrote all this down. And it's actually remarkable how well he wrote the history of this war. His name was Josephus. And so, you know, at this time, you know, a lot of the Christian Jews, so the ones who were still very Jewish but had become Christians, they left Jerusalem. Many of them went to Antioch and to other cities where Christians were already established. At that time, of course, Christians also, because there was a lot of anti-Jewish sentiment coming from the Roman authorities, a lot of the Christians kind of wanted to make sure the Romans knew, like, oh, we're not Jews, you know, we're Christians. And so there's a lot of emphasis on we're Christians, we're not Jews. And of course, that already existed because the Jews in different cities would often complain to the Romans about the Christians. And so Christians were already doing that, but this really accentuated this divide between, okay, these are Christians and these are Jews. And there were a lot of Christians who were still kind of living kind of like Jews more still. And so that this kind of furthered the process of the division. And of course, the temple was destroyed in the year 70 when finally the Romans crushed them. And it's interesting to note that this is, the year 70 is exactly 40 years after Christ began his public ministry in the year 30. It's interesting to note that. But again, we see this number 40 coming up. And you know, so it's really, you know, Christ, of course, predicted that this was going to happen. You know, and when he says, and he talks about in the, I forget which gospel it is, but in the gospels when he's talking about, I think it's Gospel of Luke, and he talks about, like, you know, flee to the hills when this happens, and you know, there's, he could be talking about the end times, but he could be talking more, also, you could say, he could also be talking about the destruction of the temple. And we know that Christians were even still using the temple up until the year 70, especially James, the brother of our Lord, the Apostle James, who was effectively, you know, the first bishop in Jerusalem. And he did not go out and preach all around. He stayed in Jerusalem. And then so all the way from, you know, 68 to like 250, 251, there were kind of sporadic anti-Christian riots, persecutions, but nothing major. Then in 250, 251, there was another major persecution under the Emperor Decius, and then under the Emperor Diocletian, right around the year 300. And so those were kind of the two big ones, the right before Christianity became legalized, but there were kind of these sporadic riots, persecutions in that period. So, Just to kind of zoom in here too, this is what it says Judea province in the first century. That's what the Romans in Latin would have called Judea. And so this just gives us an idea that, you know, when we talk in the Gospels, it's important to always remember that, you know, Christ and all his disciples are from up here. They're not from Jerusalem. They're not part of the elite circles in Jerusalem. You know, this is like being from, I'm from Pennsylvania, so I have to joke. This is like being from West Virginia, you know. This is like, and Pennsylvania would make fun of West Virginians a lot. This is like being from West Virginia. This is like the backwoods, the Appalachia, you know. And so then that's part of the reason why they were really, kind of people really skeptical. And of course, they said that about Christ. They said, "Oh, can the Christ come from Nazareth?" You know, because they didn't know he was actually born down there. But you know, so it's good to keep in mind. And these had even been separate provinces, you know, for a time. And of course, for centuries before that, with the divided kingdoms of Israel and Judah, and these had been separate as well. And the centuries before Christ and before the Babylonian exile and everything. So if we go to the apostles, the other apostles, of course, are martyred in other locations: Armenia, Persia, Greece, Egypt, possibly India, St. Thomas, possibly Ethiopia as well. John, the beloved disciple, was the only one who was not martyred. John was the only one who was not martyred. And what he did was a bit different. So he basically settled in one place. He settled in Ephesus, and he set up a school. And it says here, in a school model likely was necessary due to the rising of heresies. And you know, he set up a community, and it's interesting because now we often, when we talk about developing our parishes, things like that, you know, we talk about, okay, we need to like develop as a community, and you know, and we try to develop up in parishes, which is actually very much kind of what John did. He built a school, a community in Ephesus. And this is modern scholars agree with this. And of course, it's in our tradition as well, that this is where he lived. The Apocalypse, of course, is written on Patmos. And so the idea, probably what happened is that Patmos is an island that is close to Ephesus, and so when he was basically exiled there, as a punishment, basically, by the city, and so that's why he was on Patmos for a time. Of course, some people believe it's a different John too, so that's a debated thing. And actually, it's not. I think in the church we always say it's the same person. A lot of scholars will say it's two different Johns. For the Gospel of John and Revelation, or somebody using the name of John. But a lot of scholars say it's the same person. We say it's the same person. And it makes sense geographically, actually.
The school that he set up.
Mm-hmm. So
who are the students?
as students, you know, I mean, the idea was, you know, we talk about disciples.
Okay.
And we talk about, I think I have it here on the next page. You know, we talk about disciples,
okay.
And a lot of, but maybe some of you ex-Protestants have heard this, that, you know, when people read John, it's like a discipleship manual, and Protestants like using the term discipleship a lot, and this is actually a good way of looking at John, you know, because this is how the gospel is written. I'll get to that in a second, but just to kind of give an overview of what he was doing. He settled in Ephesus. Paul was there first, or around the same time. It was a huge city, so maybe they were there at the same time and didn't even know, possibly. And there were other new Jewish Christian immigrants, as I said, at that, especially after the persecutions and after the Jewish War began, a lot of Christians then left Jerusalem. A lot of them came to these other cities. And very importantly, he was an influence. This school of John was an influence on many well-known early bishops. St. Ignatius of Antioch, who wrote seven letters that we have. St. Polycarp of Smyrna, who wrote one letter that we have, and also his martyrdom is also written. St. Melito of Sardis, there's a book, we have it we have his work in our parish library, actually, as well as the other ones, and others. And this, they're in our parish library, actually, works by all three of these, or at least two of them. And then also eventually St. Irenaeus of Lyon, who was a disciple of St. Polycarp of Smyrna. And St. Irenaeus of Lyon wrote a gigantic book at the end of the 2nd century that I read at seminary, and it's very interesting.
Something that I was kind of amazed by in doing some study, I got the book about St. Ignatius. Mm-hmm. There's even a major road named after this called Ignatius Way.
Yeah.
So he must have had a great deal of influence mm-hmm. for, you know, public road to be named after him.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because he actually, I have another slide more in depth on him in a bit, but he actually was martyred in a very public way. And as was St. Polycarp, and you know, they brought the whole stadium there as they would do the, you know, feeding people to the animals and stuff. And so, you know, like if you've seen the movie Gladiator, you know, it's really like that, like the huge Colosseum with all the people. So when we talk about the school of John, one thing that we're able to do when we look at these early authors, not only do these authors themselves talk about their personal connections with John, they also talk about the kind of there's a certain kind of language that they all use. And so within the Gospel of John itself, it's very interesting that the Gospel of John, at the last two chapters, they say, we know that his testimony is true. And they use these terms, you know, that there are people talking about. This book is obviously not just written by one person. Now, in the sense it's written by John, this is all things that taught by John, written by John, but right in the John 21, it says, they say we know that his testimony is true. So there's obviously a group of people around John who kind of finished the work, in a sense, or wrote it down for him. And some of St. Paul's letters are like this. I mean, it's a lot of St. Paul's letters that will say, at least two of them, I think, that will say at the end, like, you know, Paul will say, I greet you, and then somebody else will say, like, and I, the guy who wrote this letter for Paul, also greet you. And so this was very common, you know, for people to have secretaries, basically, you know, as many you know, people have nowadays. And so, you know, when we talk about this we language in John, so in John, in John 1:14, when they say the Word became flesh and dwelt in us, or among us, but really it says in us, you know, this, we're talking about us, and so it's like, were they talking about, they're not really talking about the whole world, in a sense, right? But when it actually in Greek, what I put here, you know, is in, and many translations will say among, but in Greek it says in. And so many people think this is actually referring, it's not only referring to Christ coming physically, it's also referring to the Eucharist, where the Word becomes flesh and dwells in us. And so it's like a double meaning, it's an intentional double meaning. And that's why the word in is used. And so, but in Greek it can also mean among, but it's an intentional double meaning. And so there's a community, you know, that with the first chapter of John, there's a community. In John 3, when Christ is speaking with Nicodemus, it's really odd because right in the middle of the conversation, it goes, all of a sudden, Christ switches from using I to using we. Christ says, we speak what we know and testify what we have seen, and you do not receive our witness. And then after that, Christ switches back to saying I again. It's very odd, but people, my seminary professor, who's a priest and a professor of New Testament, he explained it that when that happens in the Gospel of John, this is talking about, it's referring to the community, and the school community that that is there in Ephesus. And so it's really important to think of, you know, these all these communities pre-existed the actual New Testament, right? You know, like when St. Paul wrote the first letter to the Corinthians, and he says what we say in the liturgy, what the priest says in the liturgy, on the night when he was given up, or rather gave himself up for the world. You know, he took bread, blessed it, hallowed and broken, and gave it to his disciples and apostles, saying, and then likewise after the supper, he took the cup, saying, and that's taken from St. Paul. And so, you know, we say, drink of it all of you. This is the blood of the new covenant, right? And so we say the new covenant, and that word is just New Testament. It's the same word as New Testament. And so that actually pre-exists all these writings. All these communities are passing down all these teachings. They're passing down the tradition of doing the Eucharist. They're passing down the words of institution of what Christ said. And there's nothing written down. And so it's good for us to remember that, you know, these books are written within communities, and the Gospel of John is the best example of that. You know, the other three Gospels, it seems, were written, you know, the Gospel of Luke, Luke was a companion of St. Paul. His Gospel was written after spending many years with St. Paul and the other apostles, disciples, even though Luke himself wasn't there. The Gospel of Mark was written, Peter basically told Mark everything that he knew, and Mark wrote it down. And the Gospel of Matthew, of course, Matthew was one of the 12, and he wrote down his Gospel first. But the Gospel of John, it's written within this community, so it's a bit different. And then, you know, in the blind man narrative in John chapter 9, again, we see this kind of language. You know, the friend Lazarus, I'm talking about, you know, this kind of friendship community. We get the same concept there. And the crucifixion scene, you know, where John is, you know, John and Mary, the Theotokos, are there. And Christ says, "Woman, behold thy son, behold thy mother." This is kind of familial community language. But it's pointing to that really, John really did take care of her. After the crucifixion, that's in the very early tradition, but also that, you know, John is actually putting on Christ, and he's carrying on, he's continuing the presence of Christ in the world, because after Christ is crucified and risen, now he says, "Woman, behold your son," and so that's like John is now taking on the role of Christ in the world. And that's what we as Christians do. We take on this role of being the presence of Christ in the world. And so it's kind of an intentional double meaning. And so these, you know, this is really beautiful how it works. So anyway, you know, the idea of a discipleship manual, that this is a community building disciples, and that this is especially with the crucifixion scene, the cross, you know, this is really where the kind of the community you could almost say is born in John, you know, where that's how the gospel is written, that, you know, John is the one who becomes the son of Theotokos in a way where he becomes the presence of Christ and passes that on to disciples. And that's how we see it, you know, in the church, that we see the church as the presence of Christ. Okay, so at this point, I guess we could stop and take some questions or comments or anything. I know that was a lot, sorry. Any other?
You mentioned that in the writing of the Gospels, mm-hmm. that Matthew wrote first and everything. What modern scholars are saying that Mark wrote the first mm-hmm. Gospel, and they're also have the Q, not to be confused with the political Q, the Quelle, the German word Q.
Yeah, yeah.
So does the church still stand with Matthew being first, or do they go with Mark with the scholars and say Mark, and they borrowed from him?
So we talked about this at seminary, and I looked into it myself. And so Saint Augustine actually I guess this was a debate at his time in the 4th century, or end of the 4th century, beginning of the 5th century. St. Augustine gives reasons why it's Matthew then Mark. And all of the early saints say Matthew is first. But the reason St. Augustine says, the way he sees it, and he was, his knowledge of the scriptures was incredible. It was like almost unbelievable. The way he said it is that Mark abbreviated Matthew. That actually, the way he saw it was like Matthew is actually a long gospel. And it is. I think it's the longest of the gospels.
Matthew was writing to the Jews, whereas Mark was writing to the Christians.
In a sense, yeah.
And giving them just kind of the basics.
Right, and that's why it's half the length of Matthew.
Right. Okay.
And so we might think, oh, the shorter one was written first and then somebody else added on. But it actually makes sense, like if you think about, like, you know, if you're in college writing an essay, you tend to write a lot and then have to edit it down, or something like that. Ideally, that's how you write. That's a good way of writing, at least. Yes?
Or as another example, an abbreviation of a book. Like, how you have the longer original version, and then there are people who abbreviate or make it smaller so that children can read it.
Or Cliff Notes.
Yeah.
Abridged version. Yeah, I read many abridged books when I was a kid. Yes.
Father on Sunday talked about we are separate from the world. Mm-hmm. Is John's gospel kind of where that concept came into being? That with the cross we've begun to be separated from everything else that's going on.
I think that was really. That was in the tradition of Israel.
Okay.
You know, already that they were set apart from all the Gentiles, the nations. And then what happened is that then in the church, now anybody can join God's people, but we're still set apart in the same way. We can go eat with non-Christians, the Jews couldn't do that, but I think it is true that, with the cross, then this comes in, that in a very real way, that, we're like a new people now.
I have a question about the temple in that, did the Christians keep going to the temple to worship? Did Peter and Paul went to the temple, but we just hear them preaching there. Did they go to worship there too?
I think so, yeah. I mean, even at the end of Acts, Paul goes back to the temple right before he gets arrested. And he, like, takes a vow and stuff. I mean, I think so. And the tradition, I can't remember where it's written down, but with James, the brother of our Lord, is that he was there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was still the temple of God. It was still the place where God could be worshipped. I don't know if they did all the rituals and sacrifices still. But even that was kind of debated. In Acts 15, they have a council with all the apostles, and they discuss, do the Christians have to undergo circumcision? Do they have to follow all the Jewish laws? And they decide, no, they don't. But I think that implies that a lot of the people who have been Jews were still doing these kind of Jewish customs, at least while the temple was still there. I think once the temple was destroyed, then I think people kind of realized, we probably shouldn't be doing that. But it's not really clear. It's, to be honest, as far as I know, it's not really clear if the apostles and leaders of the church who were in Jerusalem were still, going and sacrificing a lamb. I don't think they were, but they might have been. But, I mean, it took time for people to, fully, for everything to kind of sink in,
They wouldn't worship in the temple exclusively, though. They also had churches in some people's houses.
Because they were doing the Eucharist, and so they weren't doing that in the temple. But I think they would just go there to pray more. Yeah.
Are they doing the Eucharist in their homes or how?
Yeah. Yeah, there weren't really any public churches until Constantine, basically, as far as I know.
So the Jews at that time, I know they had their hierarchy, the Sadducees and the Pharisees and all that stuff, but did they have different sects like the Jewish community is now, where they have very distinct, different beliefs from one another?
I'm sure to an extent they did. So the whole rabbinic tradition, I mean, that, which is what we have now,
right, is
there was, at the time of Christ, there was this fight, the Sadducees and the Pharisees. The Pharisees basically won, because what happened is that the Sadducees depended on the temple, and so when the temple was destroyed, people couldn't do the sacrifices and all that stuff like they could before. And so the priesthood fizzled out. Now, they still kept priests, and even today, if you meet a Jewish person with the last name Cohen, that means that they're descended from a Jewish priest. Yeah. Anybody with the last name Cohen, that means they're descended from a Jewish priest. That's what that last name means. The rabbinic tradition, the rabbis basically won out. I think all that division between I think that was much more recent.
Okay.
Yeah, from what I know. But I'm sure even then there were some Jews who were more observant and less observant. But now it's kind of more formal divisions.
Well, yeah, their rabbis are like rock stars to them. Many of those rabbis are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like what they say is just like what goes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I do. I just have a couple slides about Ignatius of Antioch, just briefly. I guess I'll just continue with that and then we can have some more questions. So then just going on from the school, there's a number of writers who we know either because they themselves say it or we can tell from their writings, we know that they're affiliated with this school of thought, and that comes out of the John living in Ephesus. So one of these is Ignatius of Antioch. So he was martyred. For a long time, we thought he was martyred closer to like 90-something AD, but now it seems pretty clear he's martyred either like 117, 130 in that time. And it basically, there's a couple things that lined up and people kind of figured it out. But anyway, so he was a disciple of the disciples. So he, some people, there is a tradition that he might even have been a child living in Jerusalem that Christ even picked up. That's not really in his writings, so whether that's true or not, it doesn't really change his writings at all. But he was a bishop of Antioch, which was a very large city at that time. He was taken to Rome, along with many other captives, to be thrown to beasts in the arena. This icon, he's almost always shown with two lions eating it, because that is how he was martyred in Rome. So what kind of happened is that, he was there in Antioch. There was a Roman army returning from the Eastern Front, and they were returning back to Rome. And for some reason, he got taken captive. Somebody was upset with him for being a Christian bishop. And he was taken along with a group of captives, and he was being taken back slowly to Rome as a prisoner of this army. And so he traveled back to Rome very slowly. And he was able to stop and write letters and stuff. So he wrote all these letters while he was being held captive and being taken back as a slave to die in the arena in Rome. And so he wrote at least seven letters. There are seven authentic letters that we have from Ignatius, Saint Ignatius. And the letters emphasize unity, and in particular, unity in the Eucharist. And he's the first writer who really writes about this idea of bishops, priests, deacons, these orders of the clergy. In the time of St. Paul, there wasn't maybe a clear distinction between a bishop and a priest, because it was there were so few communities that it was every community was a bishop, basically. But this kind of differentiated over time, where you would have like a big city like Antioch, you might have, instead of just one community, now you have like 10. And so you would have one of the priests was considered the bishop of the whole community, like the senior priest. And then eventually it became like a different rank of ordination. The word bishop, of course, is episkopos, which means overseer. Literally, it just means episkopos, oversee. And the word, you know, for priest, that's normally used is also the word for elder, presbyter. And so in many denominations where they use like these terms, presbyter, elder, we're actually, you know, we say the same thing. If you were in Greece, they would say the same thing, you know, presbyteros, to refer to a priest. But of course, there's also other words we use now too. He emphasized unity in the Eucharist, because at his time, there were a couple heresies that were going around, and I'll get to that in a second. But let's just talk about another saint who's mentioned, who was another. Now, St. Polycarp mentions very specifically his disciple, St. Irenaeus, talks about how St. Polycarp was trained as a student of John. He is one who is taught by the Apostle John. And what's really awesome about this is that, you know, and oftentimes, you know, we tend to think like there's the period of the scriptures, and then there's the church fathers, and there's like this division kind of. It's like, well, this happened and then that happened. These are like two separate things. But with saints like St. Polycarp, who was a disciple of John, St. Ignatius very likely was also a disciple of John, or at least for a time, you know, had some interaction with him. St. Polycarp definitely was. He shows that there's not really a strong division between the apostles and then the church fathers and the saints who succeeded them. You know, there's a direct lineage of people. And so this says in Greek, it says, martyrdom of holy higher martyr Polycarpus. And he was martyred in fire, although he actually didn't die in the fire. Then they came and chopped off his head, but they first tried to kill him in fire. And for whatever reason, when they martyred him, he was a huge public event. He was 86 years old. And it was written by one of his disciples, and for whatever reason, they didn't persecute all the Christians. It was just like, oh, let's just kill their leader, and that will demoralize them all, and they'll all just give up. And they thought that would be more demoralizing just to kill the leader. But it actually, of course, didn't work. It backfired. More people became Christian. So that's the story of St. Polycarp. So as I said, he was taught by John in Ephesus before later becoming bishop of Smyrna. Smyrna is very close to Ephesus. He was an important leading bishop in the early mid to second century and helped resolve some inter-Christian debates. He was martyred around 155. Works by, to, or about him. So he has one letter to the Philippians. St. Ignatius wrote a letter to St. Polycarp. There's the martyrdom of Polycarp, which, as I said, is written by one of his disciples. And then in St. Irenaeus, in his huge book against the heresies, he mentions St. Polycarp several times. So it's interesting, you know, that not only was he just a famous martyr, as St. Ignatius was, but they also very much were fighting against all these different strange ideas that were popping up. And St. Irenaeus, who was a disciple of Polycarp, so he was about 40 or so years younger, he wrote a whole book against the heresies because there were so many different teachings. And so this is just an excerpt from St. Irenaeus' book. But Polycarp also was not only instructed by apostles and conversed with many who had seen Christ, but was also by apostles in Asia, that means Turkey, modern-day Turkey, appointed bishop of the church in Smyrna, whom I also saw in my early youth, for he tarried on earth a very long time, and when a very old man,
gloriously, most nobly suffering martyrdom, departed this life, having always taught the things which he had learned from the apostles, and which the church has handed down, and which alone are true. To these things all the Asiatic churches testify, as do also those men who have succeeded Polycarp down to the present time, a man who was of much greater weight and a more steadfast witness of truth than Valentinus and Marcion and the rest of the heretics. It just has that one. He it was who, coming to Rome in the time of Anicetus, caused many to turn away from the aforesaid heretics to the Church of God, proclaiming that he had received this one and sole truth from the apostles, that, namely, which is handed down by the church. There are also those who heard from him that John, the disciple of the Lord, going to bathe at Ephesus, and perceiving Cerinthus within, who is a heretic, rushed out of the bathhouse without bathing, exclaiming, "Let us fly, lest even the bathhouse fall down, because Cerinthus, the enemy of the truth, is within." And Polycarp himself replied to Marcion, who met him on one occasion, and said, "Dost thou know me? I do know thee, the firstborn of Satan." Such was the horror which the apostles and their disciples had against even holding verbal communication with any corrupter of the truth. As Paul also says, "A man that is a heretic, after the first and second admonition, reject, knowing that he that is such is subverted and sinneth, being condemned of himself." There is also a very powerful epistle of Polycarp written to the Philippians, from which those who choose to do so and are anxious about their salvation can learn the character of his faith and the preaching of the truth. So this is just one of the things that St. Irenaeus says about St. Polycarp, but I want to put this full quote here because we can't lose track of the fact that, you know, this is really, there's really like good evidence that, you know, we follow the people, you know, our bishop is Archbishop Paul, and he succeeded, he comes from a line of bishops, you know, who descend from all these saints, all these bishops, who go straight to the apostles. And so this is, you know, this shows us, you know, that this emphasis that St. Irenaeus puts on the importance of following the people who follow the teachings that the apostles taught. You know, so that's what we're doing even up to this day. When he talks about, you know, they don't even want to talk with heretics, you know, when we have to be very careful when we use this term heretic. We shouldn't just call any random person who isn't Orthodox a heretic. That's not a good thing to do, for many reasons. But a heretic is somebody who is, at that time, somebody who's in the church, who then creates a new teaching and tries to lead people out of the church. So it's like a technical term for that. They weren't just saying, oh, any random person who believes something slightly different from what the church believes is a heretic. They wouldn't say that. But a heretic is somebody who tries to lead people out of the church and follow them and follow their new teachings that they made up. So that's what a heretic is. So we should be really careful today when we call, we shouldn't just, you know, throw around that term very lightly. You know, and they talk about how the heretics deceive people. So the people if the heretic deceives somebody and tricks them to follow them, that doesn't mean those people too are heretics. They're mistakenly following a heretic. You know, so it's kind of important to keep that in mind. But anyway, we see that they're very serious about following the correct teaching. You know, and even calling the Marcion, who was a famous heretic of the mid-second century, who led a lot of people out of the church. He calls him the firstborn of Satan. So they're very serious about this. So just briefly, St. Irenaeus of Lyon, disciple of Polycarp in Smyrna. At some point in his life, he moved to France, Lyon. He died right around 202 AD, we're pretty sure 202, when he was martyred. He wrote On the Apostolic Preaching, Against the Heresies, the Letter of the Churches of Vienne and Lyon. These three works are he wrote other books, but these are the ones that survive. The middle one, Against the Heresies, is a five volume. It's a huge, if you have the thing, it would be like a book this big, it's huge.
So, a very prolific author and saint. And the letter of the churches of Yan and Lyon is a really beautiful letter. It's actually preserved for us by a 4th century author, Eusebius, who copied it down. So you can, all of these you can basically find online for free, actually. But it's about, this one is, it's a very beautiful, it's an account of the martyrdom in Lyon of several Christians.
Has that recently been ascribed to him? Because I didn't remember that being...
It's not ascribed to anybody, but...
Okay, but it's the same martyrdom where
he
was martyred.
People are pretty sure it's him because they know that he then became the bishop of Lyon.
Okay.
And so they're quite sure it's written by him, and it kind of matches his style and everything. But it is true that it doesn't, that one, it's not, there's not 100% certainty that it's him, but they're almost certain that it's him. So it's just to kind of overview teachings of Ignatius, Polycarp, and Irenaeus. They really emphasize, teaching what had been passed down to them. They were familiar with all the New Testament books and letters. It's kind of amazing how quickly Christians disseminated all the letters of St. Paul and copied them and sent them to each other. So St. Ignatius, dying maybe 60 or so years after St. Paul died, he's referring to all these different letters that St. Paul wrote to all these churches, and St. Polycarp, and especially Irenaeus. I believe St. Irenaeus, because he wrote so much, I think he refers to every single book in the New Testament, except for maybe 2 Peter. I think he refers to every single book in the New Testament, which shows that there was already basically a canon of scripture by then. Not totally, it wouldn't be totally set for another like 150 years or so, but there is still a very strong idea of a canon of scripture. They emphasize the importance of unity, the Eucharist, and martyrdom. So the idea is that we have to have unity as in our community, again, coming from the Gospel of John, this emphasis on the community. The community is so important because all these people outside the community are teaching things that are wrong about Christ, especially by this time. So in the 2nd century, you have Docetists. St. Ignatius writes against them, especially, as do the other ones, as do St. Polycarp and Irenaeus. But Docetist comes from the Greek word dokine, docetist. And what that means is to appear, in the sense of like to appear as. And so they taught that Christ kind of just appeared as a man. He was the Son of God, divine Son of God. And then he came and he just kind of appeared as a man. He wasn't really a man. Cerinthus, who had just heard St. John the Evangelist ran out of the bathhouse when he saw him. Cerinthus and his take on this kind of sensual millennialism. So they believed that when Christ came again, he would reign on earth for 1,000 years, and it would be like a big party for 1,000 years, and all the bad senses of big party. And they really believed that.
Some people still do.
Yeah. The Docetists, that's basically what Muslims believe. Not in the total sense of, but not exactly, but the Muslims believe that Christ wasn't really crucified, that he appeared to be crucified, but it was like a trick. Like he switched places with someone. So even that is actually kind of still there. Ebionites and other kind of overly Jewish influences. In Hebrew, I think, or Aramaic, means poor. And so they were called these poor people because they believed that Jesus was not the eternal Son of God. They just believed he was like a really great rabbi. They were Jews, and then they would also do the Eucharist, but they did everything else as if Christ was not really the Son of God. So they were kind of strange, but that was very popular at that time. Marcion... at the time of Polycarp, so this is like around 140, 150 AD, he was a very wealthy man, very influential man, And he started this heresy. He went to Rome and other places to preach it, where basically he said, you know, the New Testament is not really credible. And so you really can only believe, like, parts of some of the Gospels and parts. And so he basically chopped up all of St. Paul's letters in the Gospels, and he made his own version of the Gospels in the New Testament. Interestingly, Thomas Jefferson did the same thing.
I was just thinking.
Oh, yeah. Thinking
Thomas Jefferson did the same thing. And so it's very interesting that so all of these things, they pop up later in history. But we see everything was there right from the beginning, basically. And there's kind of Gnostics. Gnosticism is kind of a catch-all term to refer to any of these people who believe, they believe some really weird stuff. So they would believe that, like, Jesus was... There's one group St. Irenaeus talks about where they say that Jesus was actually like 32 different beings. And so, like, when it says like word, that's like one being. And when it calls him like Son of God, that's like a different being. And so they were almost overly literal, you know, where it says like Christ says, I am the door. Like, oh, he's a door. You know, Christ says, I'm the good shepherd. Oh, he's a shepherd. And like, oh, it's different beings. And so they were really like, they were really, strange, obviously, but there were different kinds of Gnostics, and St. Paul, you know, had to deal with some of these kinds of weird teachings in his letters, it seems. But anyway, so the basic overall thing, you know, is that there are people who want to deny that Christ really became human. There are also people who want to deny that he was really the Son of God. There are also people who, you know, want to just be able to do whatever they want with their bodies. There are also people who want to be able to just use whatever scriptures they want and not use other ones. And there are people who believe, like, really weird out there stuff. So we see all this today. Just quickly, a couple other church writers of the period. St. Justin Martyr, who was also called Justin the Philosopher. He had a small community in Rome. He wrote several books as well. He seems to have also been a kind of involved. He might have known St. Irenaeus. It's not really clear. Melito of Sardis, he wrote a book called On Pascha, which is in our parish library as well. It seems to be kind of a, almost like liturgical kind of text, like almost like a, not like for liturgy, but almost kind of like a, it was kind of like a vigil in a sense. But what it was he wrote this long, almost like an epic poem about connecting Exodus and Pascha, which of course Pascha means Passover. And so, you know, making that connection between, you know, the Exodus with Moses and the Israelites, and the Exodus that, you know, Christ leads us out of death into life. So he kind of wrote this, it's a really interesting text. It's like a poem, basically. And so people think that it's probably used kind of in, as a, kind of like a, you know, like when you do like the hours before liturgy, maybe he just like did the poem, then they did their liturgy or something. So, but yeah, so then Polycrates of Ephesus, there's not really much written by him, but I actually don't really think anything, but except there's one excerpt from him that's in this history that was written in the 4th century, and he talks about, like, he has all these predecessors who then knew John, and so he talks about how in Ephesus there was the strong tradition of John being there and training all these people. There's also Hermas, that's an interesting book. And that goes with that. And then Papias, Hermas talks about, yeah, like kind of, he's a rebuke to the shepherds of the church, people who he sees as being a bit hypocritical, maybe. And then Papias, he talks about how he knew many of the disciples of the Lord, and he emphasizes the importance of a living voice over just something written down. And it's interesting because at times these early fathers, sometimes they had to emphasize, well, all the heretics, you know, the heretics don't believe in tradition, and so we believe in tradition, and we descend from the apostles. And then sometimes they had to emphasize, well, the heretics throw away the scriptures. So, you know, it's really important that we have tradition and scriptures. You know, and scriptures are, you know, the main thing that is passed down to us in tradition are the scriptures. Then we also have the other tradition around it, and you can't throw out one or the other. And that's what all these saints of this period were emphasizing. It's very interesting. And so, you know, why learn this, you know, help us understand our own beliefs better. Especially as Orthodox Christians. They help explain to us, other Christians, why we believe in what we believe regarding tradition. These earliest disciples of the apostles, they emphasize tradition. We emphasize tradition. Of course, you're here, you're Orthodox, you know that. But it's good to think about that. You know that I think a lot of people who are Protestants and they really don't believe in tradition, it's because they don't know that these early Christians were emphasizing tradition so much. They don't know that. And I think it's just a simple ignorance in some sense. There's an unbroken chain between the apostles and the rest of the church after them. And they challenge our preconceptions and misunderstandings of Orthodox doctrine. So sometimes these saints in the early church, they'll actually say some things that seem a bit strange. Because we tend to think in a very formal sense of, you know, we believe in the Trinity, and this is what it means, and if you're Roman Catholic, you draw a diagram of the Trinity, and all that. But, you know, at that time, these things weren't 100% all laid out like that. There was no, like, big, there were no catechesis books or anything. And so the terms that they use are a bit different at times, and so they're not wrong, they're just different. And so it's good to kind of keep that in mind. So, okay, so next time we'll kind of focus more on Ignatius of Antioch and look at more specifically at some of his writings. So any questions about it? Yeah.
I forget which one of these guys it was who said, whenever I meet someone who knew one of the apostles, I always ask, you know, what else did they say? What was their manner of life? How did they speak? And do you remember which one that was?
That might have been a Pius.
Pius?
Okay. Might have been, yeah. I think so. But that was a big emphasis to actually have, like, known the apostles and to have seen them.
So when the early Christians who go to the temple to pray after Christ, mm-hmm. they would go home to break bread. When they broke bread, did they say something like, this is God. Okay, so
this
that
is my body. Yeah.
So that that comes past, right? That's part of the tradition, though.
I mean, Christ really, you know, Christ said that to
he
the apostles,
that, right?
And it's and what's so interesting is that, you know, Saint Paul's first letter to the Corinthians is people believe that that was written. That's one of the earliest texts of the Old New Testament. Most of the Gospels are written in like the 60s ish. Because the Gospels, the theory is that the Gospels were written when, oh no, Peter and Paul and all these apostles are getting martyred, we better write down the Gospels. and so that's kind of when the Gospels were written. Now, St. Paul's letters are earlier. They're a good, they could be as 20 years earlier, you know, 10 years earlier. And so when the formula that we use in church comes mostly actually from St. Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. Because it was already passed down verbally.
So were individual families saying this prayer, or was, they went to their homes.
They would gather at somebody's home. So usually, it was like a super stratified society.
And that was one of the reasons that Christianity was so persecuted back, because they were accused of being cannibals. Because they actually called them the body, they said they were eating the body and blood of Christ.
And people heard that. And they
got real upset about that.
Because they didn't know what they were doing in the house, you know, but they heard that they were saying. But normally, because society was so stratified at that time, normally, like in a city, there would be like, okay, there's this one you know, wealthy person, you know, the 99% poor people and 1% wealthy, and oh, there's the one wealthy person who converted, so we're all going to meet at their house, basically.
Probably at a bigger house.
Yeah. Well, and people would have a household and slaves and everything in their households. Yeah. And multi-generational families, you know, living in one house. So yeah. Any other questions or comments?
It's a lot of information.
It was a lot, I know. It was a lot. Yeah. But I just, you know, so what we'll do in the next couple of classes, we'll kind of go in depth. We'll go more in depth St. Ignatius, more in depth St. Polycarp, more in depth with St. Irenaeus. Yeah, but it's just good to, the main thing I wanted you all to get out of this class today is that we have the written record, we have the evidence that there were all these saints, all these bishops who passed on the teachings of the apostles. They wrote against the people who changed those teachings, and we follow these same teachings that these people, the bishops who followed after the apostles, we follow those same teachings. And it's really important to emphasize that. That there is that connection there. And there's a lot of written evidence of it. Because there are other, you know, there are other saints. I mean, you know, we don't know anything they wrote. A lot of saints, right? Like, you know, we have St. Paul's letters to Timothy. We don't have any letters by St. Timothy or by Titus or other people he wrote to. But we do have some. All right, you're probably hungry. You're saying. Go home and eat dinner.
Thank you for putting this
up. I guess we went an hour, a little over an hour. Sorry, I wanted to keep it to 1 hour.
Very good, thank you.
All right, we'll pray quickly. Let's sing it.
It is truly me to bless you, O Theotokos, ever blessed and most pure and the most. Defilement, you gave birth to God the Word. True Theotokos, we magnify you.
All right, thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Father.
So I'll try to keep it under an hour. Sorry, I think we went over an hour.
It's okay.
Mama.
Yes,
Mama. Mary started this for me, and she told me to keep it loose so we can.
Yep.
Okay,
go ahead.
Nice. Sure. So I wrote some stuff on the last two pages. I wrote some stuff down from the sheet.
I noticed that. Do you know what any of this means?